Hello, and welcome to another Emmy edition of the Water Cooler Podcast. I'm your host, Clarence Moy, and I'm joined by Joey Moser this week. And Joey, I think you've been talking to some people about exploding dead rats. What's up with that?
You know, all in a day, exploding rats. Yeah, I spoke to Paul Graff, who is the visual effects designer of Stranger Things. I actually had no idea that the visual effects team behind Stranger Things hasn't won an Emmy yet.
That's surprising.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I just assumed that they won one. And I spoke with him for, you know, a little bit about, exploding rats, of course. And then he told me about some, like, just little visual effects work that we may not realize or is visual effects, such as like creating that scene on the hill where the kids go at the very beginning. And then he talked to me about the some of the difficulty, I think, about filming in the mall a little bit, because that huge finale, there's a lot going on in there.
Excellent. So this is your podcast interview with the visual effects supervisor of Stranger Things Season 3. And be sure to listen to Awards Daily TV's Water Cooler Podcast more in the upcoming weeks, as we're going to bring you more and more Emmy interview podcast content as we head into Emmy voting phase one. So thank you, Joey. And here is your interview with the visual effects supervisor of Stranger Things 3.
Hey, Paul.
Hey, Joey.
How are you?
How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, getting used to the four walls of my apartment. How are you?
Yeah, I'm actually doing pretty good.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's nice to have this really calm time.
Yeah.
Everything like that in the last 40 years.
Yeah, definitely very unprecedented. So I really love season 3 of Stranger Things. It's actually my favorite season. So thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Is there an art to making rats explode?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, there is. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the thing is, the whole thing started with a conversation with the doctor. Like, every season, I mean, there's a lot of time pressure. It's always, like, really backloaded. Like, they are, like, everybody wants the next season. They basically, they finish one season, and they go right into the next season. And as soon as they can get out these scripts, we start shooting, basically, right? And the kids are growing. There's really, like, there's significant time pressure on this show.
Yeah.
And the whole thing starts with, like, a conversation. And the Duffers, in my mind, you can always quote me on that. In my mind, they're, like, some of the most talented directors out there, you know, probably of their generation. I don't know. Like, but I'm a big, big Duffer fan. So they can do, I mean, they flew around with Obama. He invited them on the plane. Steven Spielberg, from what I know, like, this, you can't quote me on this, but Steven Spielberg told them, here's my box, take whatever you want. And they stick with Stranger Things, and they stick with Stranger Things because they get to make a new experiment, like, every season. The thing is, you just know, it's like you get a new box and you open the box and it's going to be different from what was in the box last year. It's like, in a way, it's not a movie, it's a series, but it's like they are sort of like have different movies that are inspiring.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
The kinds of movies that they want to do. So this time they said it's going to be like Cronenberg, you know, like The Thing was the thing for the show, for the season. And they wanted to play with that kind of gory, wet, red, fleshy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that was like sort of like that was their toy for the year. and like in the previous season, like, we had the Demogorgon, then we had the Shadow Monster, and now they said we want something more tactile, like something that we can... So we basically went from ethereal and like the stormy, shadowy monster that has really no body, that's sort of an entity of little particles.
Yeah.
We want this to turn into something heavy and wet and gory and stompy and a dinosaur-ish in size eventually. And so there was a lot of analyzing old movies from the 80s to get like sort of like a visual of what it is that they respond to. And what we found is it's a lot about moisture.
Okay.
You know, it's really what makes these things work, what makes these special effects things from the 80s work and partially better than digital things that have been done later.
Mm-hmm.
Is a few parameters. Like one of them is like it's wet and drippy and glossy.
Right.
Right. It's heavy. You don't see everything. It's kind of like hidden in shadows. It's not about being super explicit and seeing every little detail, but rather sort of like be a little bit amorphous and high contrast and get this kind of glibbery feel going. So. As far as the rats, the rats exploding, that's basically very similar to the Demodogs in the last season. It's following something from its inception, from its baby steps into something really big, right? And this time even a lot bigger than we were in season two. And so it's the goo. And the rats, that's the first time we see, and we actually have that in the first chapter where we see the particles tying with the rats, attracting the rats. And
then
it's in a way, in a nutshell, what's going to happen is like one of those big story threads that's going to go weave its way through the whole season.
Yeah, the way that you mentioned like the moisture, like when I was rewatching some of the scenes this week, it was sort of like, I just kept writing down just allusions that it sort of reminded me of. I was like, maybe like a little bit of something like Ghostbusters or something, a little bit like the remake of The Blob, the way that, or something, even something like Alien a little bit. Like, I love sort of how like the creature builds, like it builds and builds until it's this gigantic, massive thing. It's sort of like you get to have like a character arc for this monster, unlike we've never really seen before. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was really awesome. So
there's basically there's three pieces that come together. There's mm-hmm. basically the recipe. Like the headline here is the recipe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have keyframe animation and we have the particle simulation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's like a mix of the two. Like they're usually quite separate pieces of CG animation.
Mm-hmm.
And for keyframe animation, you need a skeleton and you need muscle and like whatever, and like you make motion studies on that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the particles, it's basically a bunch of chunks of meat that follow a shape. And then the third one is this glue, like there's this coating of glue that's over everything. So the very first thing that we really identified, like I said, is this needs to be wet and glossy and drippy. And so it's always a mix of those three elements. And in a way, the rat coming out of the cave, like the rat exploding was like maybe our first test of this whole conglomerate. And then the rat coming through the cages, the rat exploding inside the cage and then coming through the cage and dripping on the floor and running away as a little critter, in a way, it's like this whole evolution, like in a microcosm. And then we knew right from the beginning, eventually this has to be also tied with the spider monster, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at the silhouette of the Shadow Man monster and the silhouette of the spider monster, like in a way, it's like literally an incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
So the monster is still this kind of particulate force that sort of like assembles itself a body. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit Frankenstein.
Yeah.
It makes itself a body. And the body is going to be sort of like T-Rex from Spielberg.
Yeah.
It's a big, heavy, something thing, and now it's interactive. It's not just like windy. It's just like when it stomps, the camera shakes and stuff like that. So that was sort of like a new playground. And so, in a way, we started the arc at the very beginning with the rat, and we already from the get-go, we knew for the final scene we have this giant stomping monster the size of a dinosaur somehow creating mayhem in the final chapter that was unwritten. We didn't know what it was, and there were like ideas that it invades the Hawkins' 4th of July parade. We knew it was going to be 4th of July, so there was like ideas that maybe we have this monster just like crash into the 4th of July parade or into the mall or whatever. We knew something like that was going to happen, and so we basically pushed go on the rat stuff, and we pushed go on the monster. And because you need to do motion studies, and we didn't have any time, and we didn't have any written scenes, and one thing we've learned in season two is that it's a really good idea to feed the duffers some visuals early on, because you have a chance, which is like amazing, you have a chance to make it into the script.
Yeah.
You know, he was literally in chapter two, in season two, we would do some tests and make some concept art, and then we would literally, in the wording of the chapters that came downstream, we would find things that were inspired of from our ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's really cool.
Of course, it's really cool, and it is definitely not a one way situation. There's some things the duffers like, and some things the duffers don't like. But there's a shot that we knew we have a shot here to play. Mm-hmm. And so I asked Rodeo, who did the monster, and actually some other vendors, like a lot of vendors were like, really, everybody wanted to do a monster. And so I said, well, it's pretty much going to be Rodeo, but like, if you want to play, here's our kit. So we built a kit of the monster early on, big monster.
Okay.
And we designed it, and then we gave it to a few vendors. We gave the kit and said, if you like, we can pretty much promise you you're not going to get it, but if you want to play with it, here's the call.
Right? That's really cool.
And then they would do really cool tests. Spin did some, 8 effects did some, and Rodeo did some, and it gave us some visuals that were really kind of like both inspiring for the writing, and at the same time, like the head of Rodeo later told me that it really gave them a leg up, because by the time these both shots came and those chapters were written, they already knew how this thing moved and what was how to make it.
Oh, cool.
So
okay.
Basically, these two things, as far as the creature work is concerned, those were our initial avenues.
Yeah.
And then, sort of like in the middle of this, and last is the Tom Bruce monster in the hospital in chapter 5 and 6.
Uh-huh.
In a way, that was the last monster we decided that we designed, because it's like sort of like halfway and we basically needed to have both ends of the spectrum covered first. And now for the Tom Bruce monster, we had to basically, we now knew what worked and what doesn't work, and just we liked and we didn't like. And
yeah.
Tom Bruce monster was like sort of like our final playground, in a sense, as far as design is concerned. And we didn't have, basically with the rat, it's just a critter. And you can see that even the rat monster, when it runs over the ground, that it has this kind of spiderish design with lots of extremities.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Tom Bruce monster had to sit somewhere in between
okay.
the rat critter and the spider monster. But we had a certain amount of leeway. Its point was that it's made out of two bodies. What we learn here is that these bodies join. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That was the story, but like we could do whatever we want with those two bodies, and we figured let's do something more like Hunchback of Notre Dame-ish, something non-symmetrical, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I said, let's do something that is not symmetrical, that's like kind of like really heavy on one side and really kind of like maybe one big, huge, stumpy leg on one side, and then lots of little ones on the other side. Let's just play with asymmetry, and that's basically what that is. And like in a way, it was our favorite toy.
Yeah.
Just
that's really cool. Is there anything that's part of this third season where like people don't know visual effects are in play? Like obviously there's like the big monsters and stuff. I was watching some sequences where they show some of the visual effects from the third season, like from you know, the very beginning when the Russians are walking around and you have to create like an entire background landscape. Is there something maybe
yeah.
that we don't know, like how difficult it is to add something in that's really small. Maybe even something like the, like when Billy is possessed and Mrs. Driscoll is possessed, like you get to see the veins on their body sort of like popping out. Like,
oh my God.
Yeah. First of all, I forgot about that. That freaked me out when I rewatched it. Is there something that, people may not understand how difficult adding some visual effects is into something?
Well, that's a difficult question.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just on this visual effects planet, you know, like where, like, of course, there's tons of stuff in there that you hopefully wouldn't know.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the tunnel extensions or the elevators or like, the weather top, when the kids are out on the weather top, we didn't mm-hmm. really have. The thing is, we had a location when they very first go up and they build the antenna, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a location. Somewhere in Atlanta on a hill, but it's really bad to get there, and especially for light, to carry up light on this hill.
Yeah.
It really doesn't work. So we knew the camera department pretty early on came and said, like, we have all of these night feed up there, and we just can't, like, we can't, there's no way where we shoot this there on location,
mm-hmm.
right? So then we were looking for another location, and really all we needed is kind of like a hump of wild grass.
Okay.
And then put some blue screens around it and change the background and add the background, right? Sounds really good, but it turns out we didn't have a hump of grass. What we had is like the studios in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of like built on a hill, and there's like grassy areas around the building.
Okay.
And we had basically one rising piece of lawn that wasn't really even a blob. It was just sort of like a rise.
Mm-hmm.
And then we put blue screens out there at night and shot this all at night at the studio, like basically on a complete non-set that was just tiny and right up, almost right up against the blue screen. And I was really fighting with the grid through for every inch of distance between the blue screen and the kids.
Uh-huh.
Because there's then also, like, I mean, you need to have depth. Everything's about depth. And if I just don't have any foreground to speak of, it gets really hairy in post.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the blue screens have to be lit, and then the light has to get cast shadows on the ground. So, like, it was kind of a little bit of a difficult situation.
Saving something like as simple as that takes so much work. My gosh, I had no idea. Yeah. I thought they were just like walking around outside.
No. I mean, it is outside, but it's like basically the size of my lawn. The lawn is the size of my yard, and it's not a very big yard. It's just a few feet. You know, enough for them to run down. When they run down, they basically, this whole scene is like with the backdrop of the exterior landscape that we shot. In stills, basically with stills, and we stayed behind on that day when we were out on the hill, and we stayed there until the sun went down. We shot HDRI, which is high dynamic range imagery, all around before sunset, went after the sun was down, before the moon came out, when the moon came out. And what was really eerie, because it was in the middle of nowhere,
mm-hmm.
is like just the moment before the moon came out, there was this kind of weird dog howling concert going on there. Like one dog started and then another one, and it was like everything was like howling. It was really weird.
Uh-huh.
And it started with the big dogs, and then it ended with the small yappy dogs everywhere in the landscape there. It was weird.
That is weird. Oh, wow. I sort of want to ask just like a generic question, really, is with the size of the monster in the mall, was that the longest sequence to perfect of the entire season?
Yeah, it was the scariest. It was the scariest for a few reasons. Like, first of all, like one thing we've learned, and then we actually learned it when Bob was killed last year,
mm-hmm.
like in season two, when Bob was killed by the Demogorgon, it's like one thing to put CG creatures in a shot, and it's another thing to have interactivity with those creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to have something. You need to have something there, and you can't. You don't really have the time to really prepare every shot in detail and be completely locked down in terms of what is going to be shot.
Yeah.
So you need something there that's flexible on set that can stand in for the monster. Now, if you have a dinosaur-sized monster, that's kind of like a difficult thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not easy. And I had learned really, like, that this is basically my number one strategy, is get something there that can stand, like, you have to have some representation, right?
Right.
And then I asked the special effects, and they made a head. I figured, well, if I don't have the legs, I need to have the head, because that's where the eye line is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so special effects, they built me this kind of black, blimp, real-sized head of the monster.
Wow.
Just with the silhouette.
Uh-huh.
And it was so, and with the pole, and it was so heavy, it was like 50 pounds or something. It was a steel frame. And just imagine like a black Zeppelin, essentially, on a pole. And it was so heavy that it was completely unworkable. And then I figured, well, I need something that's big and it's light, and that's on a pole that can really move, that can be puppeteered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ideally, you'd have like a crew of like Cirque du Soleil, you know, of like 10 people puppeteering.
Yeah, yeah.
Monster or something. But that wasn't going to happen. And it also, it's just like, it needs to be easy and flexible, and you can't have like 5 people involved in it, you know. So what we ended up using is we bought like a bunch of beach balls.
Mm-hmm.
Like blow-up beach balls that are like 4 feet diameter.
Oh, wow.
And then taped like a camera, camera tape on it, and then put it on a boom pole, like a sound boom pole that's
mm-hmm.
like 20 foot long. And with that, we could like really move this head fast and quickly, and the camera knew where to look. It didn't look super sexy, but it really held up for the work. And he would say, we would have the boom pole, this is where the head is, and then 1 foot would be here, this is the diameter, you know, this, you have to think. There's the two front, it's basically the head and the two front legs and the shoulder would really make up the silhouette of the monster. So we would tell the director, so 1 foot would be probably here and 1 would be there. This is about the size. And we'd have like visuals of show, like concept art and story cleavage that showed where the monster was at one time. And then we had our beach pole as a sort of stand-in for the monster.
Okay.
That gave us something to work with. And then, the other thing, so now we have to do this monster. There has to be all of this destruction we can't possibly, like, it's a real mall. We can't destroy the mall. Obviously, we can't break the windows. Or, like, we can't. The only thing we broke was the gas windows. Those were practical.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest was like a bunch of debris by art department. Like, basically, we shot everything before. So the monster came through the ceiling in front of the weekend, and then everything after. On the Monday, and so over the weekend it was redressed for like post monster came down, right? And some of the shots were shot actually later, that was before, and then we had to paint out the debris and stuff like that. But big picture was like our first AD, but to be organized this whole shoot around this like breaking ceiling.
Yeah.
And, so then the next thing was okay, now we need fireworks.
Oh yeah.
And fireworks indoors is also, like, I mean, for all kinds of reasons, that's not a good thing to do.
Right.
And but you know, everything in visual effects, so the one thing in visual effects that's the worst offender of like making shots not look good is bad light, like when the light doesn't match.
Right.
And so you have to always say, you can't really relight somebody in post. Like, you need to make sure you know where the light is and what the light is, and catch that light when you shoot, and register that light. So that's where all of those silver balls come to play,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and the thing is with the buffers, the lighting is always very erratic and flashy and like left and right, and like it's total chaos. Whenever it gets tough, the lights start flickering,
mm-hmm.
and then so now we have flickering lights, we have the fireworks extravaganza with the monster inside of this mall that's breaking, and it's like slowly disintegrating, and there needs to be somebody who keeps track of like at what point what is broken and what is not, and it's not going to be physically broken because we can't, but we need to know what it is. So we kind of taped, we kind of kept track of, okay, the monster has stopped here, it has knocked out all of these light bulbs. So somebody was always in charge to sort of like figure out like what is has to be replaced later, so we have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we did the fireworks, we did them with like LED lights, and we had like the first four or eight or so choreographed, where there's a red light, a blue light, a green light, whatever, and then we matched that. And then after that, it's a complete mayhem. So when we had the shooting day, it's basically, we started always with that same cadence. Mm-hmm. And then there's like so many angles and so many versions. And then there's like, let's go a little closer, like a wider lens. It's like from this balcony, from there, from like
all kinds of places.
And at some point, it's just like chaos, right? It's just like chaos and like all kinds of colors. And it was really, like we did a few tests with actual fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
And shot them, and like one thing that we realized really quickly is that they are too bright.
Okay.
Because especially if you take a real firework and let it off in the mall, it just goes from dark to like completely white out, and it doesn't look sexy. You know, it doesn't look.
Yeah.
Sexy. It needs to be like light is really basically what directs the eye. Everything is about light. Like it's the most important thing there is, and so. We had this like digital light, and like with the CG fireworks, we did some tests, and then with CG fireworks, we realized like this is believable. You know, this is working. Okay, this is gonna work. So forget about the elements. Let's just go all. Let's put all of our eggs in the basket and say we'll do CG fireworks, and then we get to really choreograph the scene. And that's something I'm like actually. For me, like every season, I've learned something. I'm basically an explorer. Like I like to do new things that I haven't done before. So that's great with the buffers.
Mm-hmm.
They always have a new present in the box.
Yeah.
And this year I learned it's really the strongest shots are where visual effects play sort of center stage are the ones where those effects are light effects, are connected with light. And so you have to all think about, like, you have to work really closely with the gaffers and have a good connection. And so you always need a light in scene that represents and brings... represent our visual effects that are later in. Like if you look at the gun, like the Russian gun, the ray,
mm-hmm.
We always have to have something there that gives us the light that we for the rest of the scene, and especially for the actors that we will fill in later and change into something else that's causing that light. So that was really challenging and fun at the same time, and sort of like a little bit of a red line through that whole season.
Yeah.
The finale is the fireworks.
Yeah. I have to say that I do think that like the some of the brightness in the show is what I think maybe drew me a little more into it, and that's what made me really, really sort of fall in love with this season. I've always been a big fan of the show, but there's something special about this season. I sort of feel like I can't put my finger on it, but I feel like what you guys did especially with the monster, like the scene of him running around in the hospital, like when the lights go dark and then it comes back up and we, you know, the monster roars. It feels like sort of like almost next level horror, the way that the tension builds. I think that's really all I have for you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I didn't realize until last night that I sort of can't believe you have not won an Emmy for this show. Like, I know you've won Emmy Awards before, but when I realized last night, I was like, he hasn't won an Emmy for Stranger Things. That needs to totally be rectified. That needs to change. So, thank you so much for your time, and I hope you have a good day.
Yeah,